Good morning, everyone. It is November 10th, the day before Veterans Day here in 2021. This is the ADK Homeroom, and I am your host, Frank, welcoming you here to your home away from homeroom. Certainly, it is my home away from homeroom. Great day to be alive here in the Adirondacks in New York State Park. 6 million acres we have out there. Coyotes were making quite a bunch of noise last night. Also last night, I myself was howling because I watched about 20 minutes of that new movie. I think it's called Love Hard. Love Hard sounds like an interesting title there on Netflix. And in that movie, the protagonist, she flies out, I think, from L.A. to Lake Placid, which, of course, is right here in the Adirondacks, Lake Placid, New York. And I had to stop watching because I was tired and I have to get up and do this podcast, right? But I also stopped watching because it's a good movie, I guess, as far as rom-coms go. I haven't seen more than 20 minutes of it. It seemed okay. Nothing too special. But she lands at Lake Placid Airport, and it's this giant airport with terminals and with a label that says Lake Placid Airport. I mean, if you live in the Adirondacks, that the Lake Placid Airport is it's like a cement strip of a road. There is no terminal. There's nothing like a gate or baggage check or anything like that. It's just a cement runway in the middle of, well, on the edge of town, right next to the city dump. And it's just nothing like the commercial airport shown in that movie there. The closest thing you would get in the heart of the Adirondacks and the High Peaks region would be the Lake Clear Airport, and it's still nothing like that. Okay, well, anyway, we've got some great poetry to go through here. It is a Poetry Wednesday on the ADK Homeroom. And we're going to look today at two fantastic poems. And I remind you that while we're not quite il n'y a rien en dehors du texte here, that, you know, we're not quite, there's nothing outside of the text, right? We don't exclude everything outside of the text. We look certainly at context and world and era and things like that. But we're really definitely not into the whole, you know, you must know which Lunchable this poet ate on Tuesdays in eighth grade in order to make sense of the poem. That viewpoint is not ours. It's just not right. You know, art can't be taken out of the world, but it can be taken out of the artist's therapy sessions. We don't need to review, you know, a poet's bashful bladder syndrome struggles in order to grasp the piece, as it were. Oh, sorry. You know, this is not the analysis where you need to know the floor plan of Pound's POW camp or the floor plan of his madhouse after writing or before writing Canto 81, for example. You go by the text, go by the world. And that's the world that we all share, right? That's the world that we all share, not some crazy fascist anti-Semitic world, Mr. Pound. Okay, so our first poem is from Richard Wakefield, and it is titled The Flesh Remembers, published at betterthanstarbucks.org. And, of course, the first thing you think of when you see Better Than Starbucks or Better Than Starbucks is, you know, I love BTS. BTS is great, the band. But I also do love BTS, the Poetry Journal. BTS, the Poetry Journal is fantastic. They do a lot of great work. The name always strikes me as a little bit kind of low bar for such a good journal, Better Than Starbucks. I mean, at least you could go like Better Than Tim Hortons or something. But that would be saying something. But it is a great journal. It's wonderful. So this poem, The Flesh Remembers, from Richard Wakefield, published in November 2021 at the top of the page there in that title. Right away from that title, The Flesh Remembers, you're thinking, ooh, this could be a good spooky Halloween season poem, right? Maybe. I mean, probably not, right? But Mary and Percy and stormy nights in the Swiss Alps with the lightning cracking come to mind, right? You know, if you hear the lightning as a crack, it's very close to you because the sound will be diffracted and the high-pitched sounds will be filtered out if the lightning comes to you, if the sound of the thunder comes to you as a rumble. But if it comes to you as a crack, then those high-pitched sounds haven't been diffracted out, and it is very close. Nice little merging of physics and, I guess, poetry, or at least sound right there. Physics and sound, very, very nice to know that. So looking at Richard Wakefield's poem here, you see the first thing maybe is that it looks like a sonnet on the page, and yep, it is a sonnet. Quick scan shows it is in fact a perfect Shakespearean sonnet. You've got your ending couplet, you've got your three quatrains, you've got your heartbeat, iambic pentameter, heartbeat like the telltale heart perhaps trapped under the floorboards. And Poe's short story, we will see. You're thinking maybe Frankenstein, right, with Shelley. And maybe that's the direction you're going. So then you start to read a couple of lines here, and yes, indeedy, right? You've got words like haunted and whispers and spirit on the deep. So then at that point, right, you do a little clap and you do your little Halloween elf heel clicking leprechaun jump, because indeed this is a ghost poem. Turns out to be a ghost poem, kind of a melancholy ghost poem, in fact. I mean, you're kind of tempted to say here the flesh remembers, how about the bile remembers, but you know, melancholy can be good, melancholy can be great, just as the Smashing Pumpkins, keeping the Halloween theorem, keeping the Halloween theme going there. And yeah, it turns out the poem is a spirit story, a ghost story of sorts, a little bit melancholy, and it's good. Love it. So let's take a read. Let's put a face on it. Let's carve it, trepan it, scoop out its brain guts, read the pumpkin seeds. All right. Here we go. So the first line, this afternoon, the old man's fitful sleep. So we're in the fall then, for sure, right? The afternoon, the light's going to be fading soon. This is autumn. An old man, check. Everything checking out here for what we expect out of an autumn poem, maybe a ghost story. And then you get that delicious word, fitful. Always look at the adjectives, right? Right? Poets know nouns and verbs often are the serious timber when you're building a poem. Those will carry a lot of the weight, but adjectives are carefully chosen. They could be the weak part. If there's an adjective in there, it's in there for a reason. So you look at fitful, and come on now, in addition to the obvious meanings, right? A fit is a section of poetry. A fit is a stanza or a canto. Did I mention, by the way, that Pound uses fitful in Canto 81? He does. Can't deny the talent there. Can't deny the evil, but you also can't deny the talent. So Pound does use fitful in Canto 81. But anyway, in this poem, right, you've got this word fitful, and you're saying, oh, a fit, that's like a stanza, that's like a canto, and then your ears are pricking up, and you think, where was the last time, or at least the most famous time, that the word fit was used like that for a part of poetry, in modern poetry? And of course, that would be The Hunting of the Snark, right? From Lewis Carroll. Maybe modern in the lowercase M instead of capital M sense. And The Hunting of the Snark, right, has fit the first, fit the second for its parts. And look, it's another monster. What kind of a monster are we talking about here? Not exactly a ghost or a haunting or an apparition, perhaps, but in there we're talking about the snark. So are we going to go on a snark hunt in this poem? Let's see. Next line. Line two you have, is haunted by the breath of new mown lawn. So together, right, we have so far, this afternoon, the old man's fitful sleep is haunted by the breath of new mown lawn. A little bit of a promoted stress, right, on the second syllable of the second foot of that line, which suggests, right, whispering the breath, this ghost that's about to appear that's whispering to us. I like that. I like that subtle use of the meter right there. And then, ooh, new moon. New moon. That almost sounds like new moon, the darkest night, the traditional Halloween-y night, or full moon could be too, but that would be a happy Halloween, a new moon, a dark moon. That would be haunted. Yes, we've got that. Spirits, yes, we've got that. We're ready here. We are ready to roast the mallows. We are ready for the treats and the tricks. And then in the next line, the spirit does appear, finishing off this opening quatrain, whispers like a spirit on the deep of waking in a long ago pre-dawn. So we are deep into the night now, pre-dawn, more darkness. We have these whispering spirits appearing to us. Who is this scary spirit? Well, the first quatrain is done. We move on into the second, and we meet the spirit. It's his dad. It's his dad. So a little bit of a surprise twist right there. And notice that we've got nice organization here. The setting of the scene is done with the first four lines, and then we go on to the next four lines. So that tells us that we are paying attention. We are meant to pay attention to the form here. That'll become important at the end of this quatrain. And his dad in the spirit says, in heaven, there will be time enough to rest. In this world, we've got hay to bale and haul. Now, you want to notice what the meter is doing for you here, right? It's iambic pentameter, obviously perfect Shakespearean sonnet. And so it presents you with a choice here. You could read it as the second line here. You could read it as, in this world, we've got hay to bale and haul. You know, that wouldn't transgress against the conventions of verse. But on the other hand, you could also substitute a trochee on the second foot, and you would have, in this world, we've got hay to bale and haul, right? And the second one, I think, is much more natural. It follows the argument of the previous line more logically by countering it. And then what's wonderful about this line, read with this emphasis in this way, is, and the meaning here is informed by the meter. It breaks the perfection of the meter, right? Just as his dad's advice is less than perfect, as we will see here, the form is supporting not just really the meaning, but the content. In fact, the form is the content here because it's breaking. It is less than perfect. You're substituting trochee for an iamb here. And then also, of course, it takes the emphasis off of we, off of the we have contraction. It takes the emphasis off of we've. And it's in this world we've, right? And just as the emphasis is coming off the father-son relationship, his dad with his terrible advice is taking the emphasis off the father-son relationship and putting it onto work and onto toil and onto discipline instead of actual love and father-son relationship and all those wonderful things that they could have had time for. The emphasis comes off the we, and it goes on to the worldly and the work and all that stuff that Robert Frost was perhaps talking about in mowing, right? We have a new mown lawn here too, don't we? So I love that about formal poetry, right? I love that the form can be the content. It's important. It's important that we don't lose that in poetry. You can do things like that with formal poetry. Bravo to Wakefield right there. Something else about this two-line quote from the dead spirit, by the way. I mean, you're putting bale, right? Bale. It could be ball. Some people pronounce ball, B-A-A-L, as Baal. And he was a false god, a nature god, according to the ancient Hebrews. And really, his dad is setting up work here, baling hay, setting up all these things as a god, really a false god, as we find out going through the poem. So baling hay juxtaposed like that against heaven in the same quote, right? The dad started that quote with, in heaven, there will be time enough to rest. In this world, we got hay to bale and haul. So putting bale against heaven like that, it really is subjective. It really is suspicious. Suspicious that bale and that bale, the old false nature god, are meant to remind us that we are looking at something false right here, some false worship going on. And of course, you have the word haul right after bail, so that puts you even more in mind of Baal and Baal and false gods. That would fit in with our idea of hunting a false monster, like hunting a false snark, right? Well, let's keep going. Let's keep being our ghost hunters on Discovery Channel and keep going through this poem here. I don't actually even know. I never even watched Ghost Hunters. Is it still on there? Is it even still Discovery Channel? I have no idea. Guess I should go discover that. Ha, ha, ha. All right. So then, you know, what do you have? You've got the father. He's appearing in a ghost fashion here, telling the son that he shouldn't rest. Echoes of Hamlet, of course, here. He shouldn't rest. He should be up. He should be getting after things and tending to the vegetation, the law, the hay, the pumpkins. Okay, it doesn't say pumpkins, but, you know, harvest season, trying to keep that going here. And then we have our next excellent use of form. Wakefield begins the next sentence before the quatrain is over. The sentence doesn't match up. The beginning of the sentence doesn't match up to the beginning of the quatrain. And what's the sense of that? Well, his dad disappears before the four-line section is complete, and his dad is gone. We move on to the next thing before the quatrain is done. And this is illustrating, it's giving us an image of how in the speaker's life, the dad disappeared too early. The dad is gone without having done everything that could have been done. Just whoop, gone before the end of the quatrain. Whoop, gone before the father-son relationship had a chance to sort itself out. Super use of form, showing us what it means to lose a soul too soon. I am doing the chef's kiss emote right now. Chef's kiss, salt bay, sprinkling the function on top of the form. Yes. All right. All the memes for this Poetry Wednesday, they're all coming out. Line 10. We're up to line 10 here. We see the reiteration of the idea that, as, and I quote here, work comes first and last in this dark place. So, you know, it's dark, hitting on the darkness theme again, hitting on the Christian imagery theme again, right? First and last, Alpha and Omega, pre-dawn and afternoon's light that the poem specifically called out earlier. We see all these repetitions of form, of function, of image again. Then we come here towards the conclusion of the poem. We have the image of the man holding up his calloused hand, right here in the last quatrain, and it's calloused so that we know he did, in fact, work hard. He did take his father's advice. That's why his sleep is fitful, right? He took his father's advice, but it's also calloused. The hand is also calloused, another meaning here, because he can't feel anything. It's rough. It's worn over. It has the signs of work on it, but now it's not sensitive. This hand can't feel anything. He's alone. He's sleeping alone. He's not going to be having anything, you know, holding his hand, no gentle warmth of a lover in that hand. He could even feel it anyway with all those calluses. I don't know. And what does he do with this calloused hand? Well, he's holding it up against the afternoon sun. The last glimmers of sunlight that he could be having, these last golden rays that he could be enjoying. Instead, he holds up his calloused hand, and like an eclipse, his calloused hand, an artificial eclipse even, ooh, maybe even a helicopter eclipse, that eclipse blocks out the sun. And it's his last chance to enjoy it. It's the afternoon, but nope, he's still not going to get to enjoy it. He blocks out the sun with his calloused hand, and he's doing it to himself. Because why? Well, because his father made him that way. Sounds a bit like Frankenstein to me, right? And of course, Frankenstein sounds a bit like God and man, doesn't it? That is the whole point. Now, right, we're up to the couplet, the traditional point where you have in Shakespearean sonnet. You could have a lot of things with the couplet. You could have a volta, a turn. You could have a look back. You could have a summary. And let's see what's going on here. Well, as you might expect from a poem like this, you've got more of a look back, right? This guy's at the end of his life, and he's casting a watchful eye onto his hand. He's not looking at anything else. He's seeing the hand. And what do we have here? We have, you referring to his hand, there where 60 years of work are shown, He reads his father's words made flesh and bone. So we are returning to our excellent form here. We've got a perfect rhyme. We've got iambic pentameter, except for at the start of the first line of the couplet, there is really sort of a headless foot, isn't it? You've just got there, the heavy emphasis on there. That hand bears a lot of weight. And the poem is telling you to put a lot, the meter is telling you to put such heavy emphasis onto that word. And so you've got even more focus on the hand. And it echoes also, I have to point out here, the rhyme in this couplet echoes back perfectly with new moan back in line two, right? We've got shone, we've got bone, and we have new moan back in line two. There's strong echo right there showing us the labor, the work, the cutting of the grass that is so painful that it raises the angry dead spirit out of the new mown lawn. All of that is made incarnate here in this guy's hand, made flesh and bone, just like a monster. So that was an excellent sonnet, right? Excellent. And note that we did, in fact, go on a snark hunt there. We went hunting for that fake monster. We slew the beast of rest and relationship in the name of work. Really, there were other better things that we could have been hunting. We could have spent our time hunting more fruitful prey. But the snark hunt has led us astray here. Themes of aging, themes of making the most of your time. Of course, the father-son relationship. And the father-son relationship, not so big in literature right now, to be honest, right? You see way more mother-daughter, father-daughter, mother relationships here, and not so much with the father-son relationship. So here you have the poet using the monstrous to demonstrate the potential of the father-son relationship, right? He's evoking that emotional reader response on both sides, right? And seeing the tragedy of what wasn't, but also you catch a little glimpse of light around that hand held up against the sun. You catch a little glimpse of light of what could be. What could be? You see the monster, but you also see the sun. He is sleeping, but it's fitful. So maybe not exactly a Frankenstein poem, not exactly a Frankenstein monster, but a little bit close enough for a figure. Perhaps even a figure silhouetted on a Swiss Alp mountainside at midnight, lit up by a flash of lightning with a crack. So you know it's close. All right, so that sonnet, that's great. That is more delicious than pumpkin pie. You cannot tell me it's not. You could, I guess, but I would just stuff the pumpkin seeds in my ears and not listen. Now, speaking of listening, you are in for a treat because our next poem up is called Listen. And it is in Better Than Starbucks from Jared Carter. Better Than Starbucks. Better Than Starbucks. Again, every time I hear Better Than Starbucks, love the journal, but I always think, couldn't it be like Better Than A&W frosty mug of root beer on a hot July morning? I don't know. Not a big Starbucks fan, but a big fan of Better Than Starbucks, the journal. So, as I said, this poem is Listening. This poem is from Jared Carter. And, all right, I can't not say this. I have to get this out of the way right now. It's true. Every time I do poetry on this podcast, we have Poetry Wednesday, we have Poetry Friday, I talk about how we don't subscribe to having to know the little details about the poet's life in order to make sense of the poem. I put this disclaimer up there first. But I got to give you a detail about Jared Carter's life here. Now, this isn't in the name of analysis, all right? It's not to understand the poem. We're not breaking the rules. I'm just including this because it is awesome, all right? Okay, so Jared Carter, right, he won the Pushcart, all these fantastic successes. That's great. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. Good job. But, all right, this is the thing, right? Jared Carter is old. He is old. That's not the detail. That's just the setup. Sorry. It's necessary setup. Sorry, Jared, if you're listening. But you're 82, man. You're 82. You got to admit that. You're getting up there. And more power to you. But look, this is just the setup. Here's the thing. He's old, and that's important to know, because this guy, this straight-up legend who graduated high school back in 1956, he still holds his high school's record for the 400-meter dash. That is crazy. What, did he run it in like 3 seconds or something? How can you still have a record after, you know, more than half a century, after 60 years, almost 70 years? Come on, man. That is true legendary stuff. Much respect. I'm doing the Atreides salute to you right now with like the chest bump and then the open palm on the forehead thing. Wow. Jared, still holding your high school record. Got to say, that's awesome. I do wonder, 400 meter dash, is it 400 yards back then? 400 meters, really? But I don't know. That's what the legend is. That's part of the legend. It's buried in the mists of time. That is deep time. Okay, sorry, couldn't resist including that detail. Now let's go on to the poem and the text. So this poem takes us like the month of November, from the pumpkins and the spirits and the darkest moons in the beginning to the blinding white of the snow. Still waiting on that, by the way, here in the Adirondacks. We had a couple snowy mornings and not much since then. All right, so of course, you know, when we look at the blinding white of the snow, we can't see anything. And this poem emphasizes that in the last stanza. But looking at the snow, you know, it's white, it's smooth, it's featureless, except for the bumps or the contours, the mound, as this poem would have it, the contours that map out what is underneath it. Instead, unable to read the snow by looking at it, we must read the snow by listening to it. Dun, dun, dun. And that's why this poem is called Listen, of course. So this is a poem that is all about that sound. It's all about that sound. It's a song, really, a ballad, in fact. It's pretty close to ballad meter. It's maybe not perfect ballad meter, the traditional ballad meter requirements, but it, you know, like the poem we just talked about was basically a perfect Shakespearean sonnet. This one's not quite perfect ballad meter, but it's close enough. Okay, close enough, certainly in this age, to be called a ballad. And definitely in call a ballad because the poem is all about the sound. The oral emphasis in the poem almost demands that we recognize the ballad and the song-like qualities here. Next thing to notice about this poem is it's all questions, right? Doesn't give you any answers at all. There is not a single sentence that ends in a period. They're all punctuated correctly. There's none of this poetic license going on, W.S. Merwin, I hate punctuation type stuff. Everything is punctuated correctly according to the traditional rules of grammar. It's just that they're all questions. They all end in question marks, not a single period. Four questions spread over 16 lines and three quatrains. So, you know, it's this poem is not about giving the answers itself, at least in a traditional content sense. This poem is about sound. So what kind of sounds do we have? First, we do have rhymes. It is a song. It's meant to be pleasing, at least in one way or another, maybe not happy, right? There's a difference between pleasing and happy. It's meant to be haunting. It's meant to echo itself. It's meant to come back again and again and again. It's meant to be remembered, to be appreciated in some form. And these rhymes, they do emphasize the natural. A lot of times rhymes get attacked as not natural, as artificial in poetry. But, right, nature rhymes with itself every 12 months. So why shouldn't we? The repetitive sweep of the snow, the seasons themselves, they come around. They cycle back around. Nature rhymes with itself every 12 months. So I feel that it's pretty natural for us to rhyme also. That repetition is far from artificial, especially if you've spent 25 years in the classroom. You know that repetition is very natural and, in fact, necessary way to speak for people to understand what you are saying. A lot of value in saying something twice, whether it's in the classroom or anywhere else. So that's the first thing about the sound. And next, you notice that in the first two stanzas, the second and the fourth lines are all very low frequency vowel sounds. Known, moan, found, mound, right? And the onomatopoeia speaks for itself with moan. That's what's going on here, a moaning. The low sounds of mound remind us that there is something buried under there. And what is the snow covering up? Well, if you're still hoping for an answer to that, you haven't really grokked this poem yet. It could be anything. No answers here. That's the point. The point is to listen, to hear the sounds, and know that something is under there, and just be in the moment. Listen to the poem. Listen to the winter. You got to have that famous negative capability that Keats was talking about, right? No futile grasping after unreachable answers here. And then the next thing about the sound to notice is that in the final stanza, you do have a shift. You do have a shift. You don't have the extreme frequencies of the earlier rhymes. You have mid-range vowel sounds here. Heard, word, ask, mask, right? You don't have flake, make, known, moan, right? The A's at the top of the frequency chart. The O's at the bottom of the frequency chart. So in this last one, the poem gets even quieter, right? It's even harder to appreciate short vowel sounds rhyming than long vowel sounds. It's harder to appreciate those mid-range sounds, mid-range frequency sounds, than it is the high or the low. Those, the highs or the lows, the extremes tend to stand out. Now, in the last stanza, we're buried in the middle of the sound of the frequency scale, and it's not quite as musical. It's quieter. It is quieter. And that's the actual subject here. It's what you hear from the snow. If you ask, here's a quote, what word from your pale mask, right? What word from your pale mask? That's what the poem is asking here in the last line. And pale, of course, is suggesting that maybe what's buried in under that mound, under that snow, under that pale, is not so alive. Maybe it's not so alive. Maybe it's just vegetation from the fall that's dead. Or maybe it's something else. But in any case, ending with a question is in some sense, it's a little bit brutal. It's not going to give us any answers at all. And if you ask the snow, think about it, right? If you ask the snow this question, what word from your pale mask? If you do that in life, just like the poem is asking, snow's definitely not going to give you an answer in words. You get nothing, and that's where the poem ends. But there is, I shouldn't say nothing, there is something, right? There is the natural sound of the snow. And you look at the title after you finish the poem, you go back to the title and says, wow, it asks us to listen. So in the final stanza, we've just asked the snow for a word from its mask, and what do we get? I mean, you tell me, you're the one standing there. You have to listen to what you're standing near. And it's easy to equate it with death, right? With the end of the poem, with silence, with the pale word and the mound and something buried underneath that, perhaps. That's true, and that's there. But it's also maybe a little bit too easy to just stop there. And the poem could be read as easy itself, right? There's no heightened diction. The language is definitely elevated over the everyday, but the diction is pretty mundane. But really, the poem, it's about more than just being easy and just the easy answer. It's about listening hard. It would be easy to see the death in winter. But if you listen hard, then maybe you can hear the life in the winter also. And maybe you can hear the rhyme in the sweep of the snow. Maybe you can hear that there's something under that mound. There's something under that mask. Oh my gosh. Did I really just say that? Whoa, something under the mask that we should listen to? Those words have some pretty political implications. There's some heavy political charge, right? We're talking 60 barrels of gunpowder buried under Parliament worth of charge type of words right there. Those are some political words these days. Something under the mask that we should listen to. But this is Poetry Wednesday. This is not Politics Wednesday. So we should probably end it there. Delightful poem from the legend, Jared Carter. Please remember to subscribe. Please remember to hit me up on Twitter, ADK Homeroom. Find me on Reddit at ADK Homeroom. Give me that feedback. Still new to this podcasting thing, only a couple months into this, and I would love to hear your feedback as I find my way through the podcasting universe. Take care.